Hey there, coffee lovers. Do you want to make your morning cup of Joe something special? Let's talk about Joe Bean Coffee, a gem right here in Rochester. I'm Chris Lindstrom, host of the Food About Town podcast and co-founder of Lunchador. I've been a longtime fan of Joe Bean. Kathy, Dina, and the whole team are passionate about their coffee and this city, and it comes through in every cup of Joe Bean Coffee that I brew at home. Joe Bean has been a part of Rochester for years, over a decade, building lasting community and a sense of belonging for everyone who loves coffee. Next time you need beans, head over to Joe Bean's Roastery at 565 Blossom Road in Rochester or shop online at joebeanroasters.com. Even better, subscribe to Joe Bean's Perpetual Joy and you'll receive freshly roasted beans on your schedule and never be without your favorite coffee. Joe Bean is more than just coffee. It's a community, a commitment, and a cup full of care.
Welcome back, Punchy Pals, to Punches and Popcorn, a martial arts movie podcast where we explore the best, the worst, the history, and the science of martial arts cinema. I am your host, Michael Huntone, and with me tonight is our genius and schlock apologist and modern-day samurai, Jason Bills.
Mike, I want to address our audience tonight by simply saying, folks, me and my friends are about to put on a little Wild West show for you. Some of you might heard about it. It's called a podcast. Now, don't get scared or anything stupid. And you'll be all right. Now, sit back and enjoy.
Oh, yeah. Jay, and now I'm totally shooketh. Okay. And of course, our own walking weapon, our samurai of science, Dr. Dominic DeMore.
What is your name? I will find you. And I will kill you. Gun, sword, we all die the same.
Yes, sir.
Tonight, we're taking a break from our regularly scheduled programming and stepping out into Samurai Spring. So, new little segment, side journey for us, because we love samurai films. And it just, you know, with the spring coming around, it feels like a great time to enjoy some samurai film. I'm super excited about, because I love samurai films. They're one of my favorite subgenres, and we really haven't touched on that yet in our podcast. So it's nice to take a little break. And I love that we're really starting this with a Western.
Yeah, pretty random.
So our movie tonight, which I had honestly never heard of until Jay brought it up, is really fitting because, as I'm sure we'll discuss, Westerns and samurai films all kind of in different ways influence each other. There's been a lot of samurai films that have been remade as Westerns. There's been Westerns, specifically like the John Ford Westerns, that were really influential to some of the great samurai filmmakers like Akira Kurosawa. But I'm getting the cart ahead of the horse here.
No, Mike, I just quickly want to say it's kind of one of the reasons I love movies is this kind of global conversation happening over the decades. Like you said, this influences that. And it's across the globe. It's kind of like, I don't know, it warms my heart. So I just wanted to call that out.
Yeah, so this is a really fun, interesting way. Not only are we jumping into a subgenre of martial arts film that we really haven't touched much on yet, but then we're bringing in a totally different genre that is also one of my favorites. So this is a really exciting, interesting place for us to start our Samurai Spring with. And that movie that we are talking about tonight is 1971's Red Sun. Red Sun would see the greatest screen samurai of all time, Toshiro Mifune, enter the world of the spaghetti Western. This joint Franco-Italian production, directed by James Bond film veteran Terrence Young, would see Toshiro share the screen with action film legends Charles Bronson and Alain Delon in a chase across the Wild West in search of a stolen samurai sword and a whole pile of money. So this is wild, and I'm excited to talk about it. But again, as I mentioned, this isn't just the first time really that we're covering a samurai film, but also the first Western. So I'm kind of interested, as I mentioned, this is one of like my favorite genres that I grew up with. So I'm interested in hearing from you guys if you like Westerns and what's your favorite or one of your favorite.
Okay. So I'm going to pick, cause I think that a lot of people consider Western like a dead genre in terms of like right now, but there's just randomly every few years, there's a really good, and that, again, I don't know if this is my favorite Western, but it's one that hit me the hardest within the past 10 years or so. It's called Hostiles. It's directed by Scott Cooper. He's actually a pretty interesting writer director, but anyways, it stars Christian Bale, and it's about it's almost, I want to say it's not like a revisionist Western in terms of like themes, and like there's a lot of, it's basically pretty cut and dry. Like there's bad guys, there's good guys, but the emotional punch, like at the end of this film, I'm jumping to the end and I won't spoil anything. Like I can't describe to you how moved I was at the end of this movie. It's one of the most beautiful moments, beautiful endings I've ever seen in a movie. And hopefully just me being vague about it will get people to watch it, but it's called Hostiles. And long story short, Christian Bale is like leading this, like some type of army, but a small group of guys. And there's this woman they come upon, and her family was just killed pretty brutally. Like her, again, we should cover this at some point because children die in it. And that's a theme for us lately. So
it is. Yes.
Yeah. And he kind of takes this woman on, and he's kind of like shut down emotionally, and she sort of opens him up. And it's like the ending is one of my favorite endings in film. And it just came out like 5 or 6 years ago. It's such a good movie. So Hostiles, please check it out. Again, maybe not my favorite, but definitely something that like was just like in my mind. I was like, oh, Westerns are kind of awesome, you know, with the right expectations.
I like it. I like it. How about you, Dom?
I'd say arguably our generation, the Western kind of, I don't want to say died out, came, was replaced. Like, I really, like, I think about it like the Western was dinosaurs, the modern action movie is the mammals. I feel like that's what happened. Like, when you think about when I was a kid, when we were kids, what was like the 80s, that was the heyday of the action movie. If you wanted action, you didn't have to go to the frontier for it. Plus, when I was a kid, I felt like there were two kinds of Westerns out there. There were the old-fashioned Westerns, which I thought were kind of hokey. And then there were the spaghetti revisionist Westerns, which were a little too slow for someone who's preteen.
That's fair. Right?
So yeah. I really went through most of my childhood not watching any Westerns, with the exception of maybe Back to the Future Part 3.
That's fair. Me too.
Right? My dad wasn't a huge Western guy. He loved the modern action movie. He was all about it. So, but what I actually really like about Westerns is in my adulthood, the revisionist Western is amazing because they're not just cranking out Western hands over fist, because they only make Westerns when they want to make Westerns. They tend to be really good. So most Westerns I've seen after that were made after 1980 are freaking amazing. And like, I'm gonna go with one that's a real obvious choice, Unforgiven. I love that movie so much. Yeah. And you know, I'd like to pour a drink out for my homie Gene Hackman.
Yes, sir.
He's amazing in that.
Oh yeah.
And what I love about the modern revisionist Western is it is a critique on the complexity of the human condition, and that's one of the reasons why like the John Wayne ones aren't as good to me, because they're kind of like rah 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 bang bang kill the bad guy. The bad guy wears a black hat. The good guy wears a white hat.
Right.
But like once you start to get where all the characters are kind of scallywags, that's when it gets good. And I love Unforgiven. But I'd also like to point out, like, there's so many other ones where they just play with the genre. Like in the past couple of years, I saw the movie Bone Tomahawk, which is a Western. Sure.
Yes,
but
sir.
It also is one of the most brutal horror movies I've ever seen.
Yeah.
So what I like about the Western is it's so ingrained in our collective psyche that it can be used as a springboard for other things. In a way, it's like jazz. Modern people don't realize that the foundation of all modern music is jazz, pretty much.
Yep.
Right? Just like the foundation of most modern cinema, especially in America, is the Western. So I think this is a really, and I'm not a film school guy, I'm talking out of my ass, but like...
No, you're spot on, Dom.
Yep.
I think this is going to be a fascinating episode because the Western is seminal in modern filmmaking, and we don't realize it.
And as Mike said, it influenced samurai films. Like I was kind of excited to suggest Red Sun because samurai plays like, you know, a small percentage of the film. But Mike, I love what you said about this being a huge influence. Like Kurosawa, like he was a huge fan of John Ford Westerns, and that's what influenced Seven Samurai, etc. And then that influenced later The Magnificent Seven, which is American remake basically of Seven. Like it's all, again, it's that that cultural conversation, which is just like,
yes,
it makes my heart so happy that, like, you know, in terms of us being, I don't want to get political and I won't, but like so divided now, like as a country, as a world, like cinema just, it kind of pushes all that aside and just like, oh, I love that cool shit from over there, let's do that. And then they just echo it back. And it just, it's really moving to me.
Yeah. And the interesting thing too, area, I think, Dom, if you explore the Western genre, which I would highly recommend, one of the things that's really come up for me is Australian Western, makes it because they had a strong frontier similar to what America had. And so there's movies that make really interesting comments on the West, in because they had this kind of culture in Australia in the 1800s, but under their own, you know, with the Aboriginals rather than, you know, our Indians.
Oh, I can't remember the movie. I'm going to interrupt you. I just saw a movie about this. It was
Proposition?
No, it's very, very, very violent.
The Nightingale?
That's the one.
Ooh, that's a rough one.
That's a rough movie. That's a Western, and it's awful. Not awful, it's a great movie, but it's just like...
By the director of The Babadook, so that's cool.
Yeah, right. Yeah,
that's and another one that's supposed to be an American Western, but clearly takes place in New Zealand. Oh, what is this?
Oh, Power of the Dog?
Power of the Dog.
Yeah, that was a
superb movie.
Yeah.
And it's just... And I feel like these movies are just using the West as a backdrop to really examine humanity.
Doctor Strange didn't use any of his magic in that, so I wasn't not for me.
Yeah. Right. But the one that Jay mentioned, The Proposition, highly recommend that one.
So good.
That's friggin' fantastic. Mm. And so just another one I'd highly recommend. It's usually streaming somewhere. Hostels, I love that one too. And that's one that has a bonkers cast, kind of like the movie that we're gonna talk about tonight. The movie I was going to mention is actually what you mentioned, Che. I don't know that I would say,
really,
I wouldn't qualify it as the best Western.
Best Western, The Hotel.
Right. But it's the one that I have the most fondness for in my heart. And that is The Magnificent Seven. And part of that is because, so my dad loved Western. You were exactly right in kind of the evolution of the action film, Dom, and for my dad, he grew up with the John Wayne movies. So for him, that's like his nostalgic childhood action movies. So as a result, that was frequently on in my house, and I'd watch a lot of those. But the one that always stood out to me was The Magnificent Seven, partly because it has, you know, my dad's favorite actor and one of my favorites, Steve McQueen, in it. But also Steve McQueen and, again, just a ridiculous cast. Yul Brynner, I think, Robert Mitchum. James Coburn, right? There's others in there, right? It's just this crazy film, and it's interesting. Part of the reason that it holds so much, you know, a special place to me is it's actually the movie that got me into samurai films, because I later discovered, you know, I just watched it with my dad and was like, oh, this is really fun. I love the whole idea of they get these kind of these badasses to come in and protect this village. And then later when I saw Bug's Life, I was like, oh, they're copying Magnificent Seven. And then I discovered that, no, this is covering Seven Samurai. And once I dipped my toe into that and Kurosawa, you know, then it was over for me. So, again, it's just a special film. And I think it's just a great example of, you know, that where Western is influenced by samurai films. But they go both ways. So
don't we all?
Yeah, I'm excited to talk about this. Yeah. Jay, I hope you will get us started here with some brilliant background in your gospel, the Gospel of the Guillotine.
You got it, genius.
Genius.
I'm a genius.
He's geniusy.
Wile E. Coyote. Super genius.
Was it you, genius?
You little genius, you.
Being a genius certainly has its advantages.
Again, I just want to praise us, because we're great. No, that we're covering a Western tonight that has a samurai in it, but also that, again, these genres echo each other back and forth so perfectly. But anyways, getting more specific, I was interested in this movie Red Sun being in the spaghetti Western genre. And it's just like, but I, you know, when I think spaghetti Western, I think directed by an Italian, you know, made in Italy, you know, and I kind of just like a vague understanding of spaghetti Western. Terrence Young directed this, like, kind of a very prolific British director. So that doesn't make any sense. Like, it wasn't filmed in Italy. But when I started digging into it, it was filmed in Spain. And I guess a lot of the spaghetti Westerns directed by Italian filmmakers were filmed in Spain because it was decently mimicking the American West.
So a paella Western.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah, we should coin that and get rolling with it right now. So a lot of those Italian Westerns that we consider the spaghetti Westerns are all filmed in Spain. And Red Sun was. Also, it was produced, a couple of the producers were Italian. So that's sort of how it becomes a spaghetti Western. And a lot of those films, like basically what I'm learning is they call them Euro Westerns, are also lumped into spaghetti Western. So anytime like a European, you know, production, someone makes a film back in the day, like they just like, hey, it's a spaghetti Western, it's fine. So, but anyways, long story short, what is a spaghetti Western? Italians were making Westerns about the American frontier, like even like in the early 1900s, I was doing some wikiing because that's where I learned my knowledge. And they had like, again, they weren't subversive or maybe even interesting, but they're just like, you know, it was kind of a conventional thing to think about America at the time. And also the wild, wild west, like it was universal, like it was global, like it was just wasn't in our state. So they were kind of mimicking that. But so it wasn't just like in the 60s, Italians started making Westerns. They were always making them and they were always basing them on like, you know, the American touchstone of, you know, the wild, wild west. But anyways, long story short, we'll jump ahead to the 60s. Sergio Leone, he makes Fistful of Dollars starring Clint Eastwood. Anyways, that's really the touchstone for what we know now as the spaghetti Western. And what makes that interesting and what he brought to the table and what has coined this genre is something that has, even to this day, is something that we are like, there's filmmakers trying to echo like Quentin Tarantino with Hateful Eight, with Django Unchained. Like, there's echoes throughout. But long story short, what is a spaghetti Western? Moral ambiguity. So think about like traditional Westerns, like think about something like High Noon with Gary Cooper. He's the good guy. And like Dom, you said, white hat, black hat, like yep. He's waiting for the bad guy. Like there's a standoff. There's not much moral ambiguity. What spaghetti Western did is it got rid of the kind of clear cut heroes and clear cut villains. Heroes and villains, you know, in quotes, would be driven by other things other than good and bad. They'd be driven by motivations like selfishness, money, revenge, even self-preservation. The characters were often gunslingers, bounty hunters, bank robbers, like kind of like not obvious heroes. And I think that's really interesting. Another thing spaghetti Westerns brought to the table that conventional Westerns from like that we were making on stateside was gritty realism and violence. So spaghetti Westerns embraced grittier violence. They moved away from more like polished, idealized images like you'd see in a studio film in Hollywood. Again, a lot of times, like kind of the nature of what they were doing, they didn't have the budgets that Hollywood had. So it was just like the mother of invention was that they didn't have a lot of money. So they had to make it look gritty because that's what they had. And also more violence, kind of like, you know, I don't want to call it like ultra violence, but there was a lot more blood, especially considering what, and again, this is like 60s, 70s, what America was used to at the time. So things were bloody, like the even just like the production code in America, again, this is more 60s, wouldn't even allow what you're seeing in these spaghetti Westerns. Again, landscapes in terms of visual were more harsh, unforgiving, reflecting realities versus the old West where you'd have like, oh, we're in a wagon and blah, blah, blah. So also we're subverting traditional Western tropes. So spaghetti Western subverted traditional Western tropes, including like a happy ending, black and white morality, which we discussed, the myth of the American frontier. That's all out the window. And that's what makes these films so interesting. Also, they often featured cynical and pessimistic narratives and characters, corrupt politics, the darker side of human nature, just all kind of really revolutionary ideas, you know, in like the early 60s and mid 60s when this started happening. Visual style and cinematography. So spaghetti westerns. And again, this is more like what Leone kind of put forward in the, you know, with Fistful of Dollars when that started late 60s. So their visual style was very distinctive, widescreen images. And they'd also have those like super close-ups of your lead character or the villain. Think about like Good, the Bad, and the Ugly. They utilize European landscapes, again, Spain, the deserts of Spain, to stand in for the American West. And it just kind of added this very unique and recognizable aesthetic. Cinematography often featured dramatic close-ups, as I discussed, sweeping shots of the landscape. And then another thing I want to discuss, the music. Ennio Morricone was a huge part. And again, that was something that, again, Sergio Leone brought to the table. So this kind of like distinctive, unconventional instruments and memorable melodies, that is something that we weren't used to prior to these films. Soundtrack often emphasized the mood and action of the film, further enhancing the gritty and the violent atmosphere. And the last thing I want to touch on is influence and legacy. So we can actually tie the spaghetti westerns to the revisionist westerns. Think like what Altman did with McCabe and Mrs. Miller, like Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid. Like, these are people that watch these spaghetti westerns and then were just like, these are awesome. And they're way more honest than what we were used to with like what John Ford was doing back in the day. Not that John Ford eventually kind of made some interesting films and blah, blah, blah. But anyways, like this was kind of like a revolution, and it's fascinating. Even as I discussed earlier, Quentin Tarantino, and to this day, we're dealing with, you know, the fallout of spaghetti westerns. It just made westerns fresh again, more interesting, more relevant. And so that is the spaghetti western. That's why we're still like talking about it now in 2025.
Ooh, wonderful. Yeah, well said, Jay. So many good movies.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's amazing. And I feel like modern westerns are great. I think because of the spaghetti western. Like, I think I saw clips of the original True Grit, and then I saw the Coen Brothers True Grit, and I'm like, I mean, if you ask me which one I'd watch, it wouldn't take me very long to say the new one, because
I love the new one.
The new one's wonderful. It's deep. It's a deep movie with fleshed out characters and kind of it subverts the whole thing because life is complex. Whereas the John Wayne one, it's like,
I will push back against that a little bit. Now, I will make my dad mad by telling him that I think the Coen brothers made a superior True Grit.
Because they did.
And that I think is very interesting. But the original, like, it's definitely, it's a interesting role for John Wayne in that, like, he's a scoundrel in it in a different way than The Searchers, which a lot of people would put. And The Searchers is, as Jay mentioned, like, Ford does something very unique with that film. And it not, John Wayne isn't quite the depth there, but still, like, different in True Grit. Plus, you get Robert Duvall as the bad guy, who I think is Josh Brolin's character in the new one. I forget. He might be Barry Pepper. Anyways, like a very young Robert. He's very good. There's a lot of really good things in the original.
Mike.
Yes.
I didn't want to interrupt you, but does the original have the Queen of Western New York in it, Haley Steinfeld? No, the answer is no, Mike.
Okay.
This is Josh Allen is not in the original. Therefore, the remake is superior. Thank you.
Hey, and I continue. I think it is. I think the original for the time it came out is much more subversive than a lot of the John Ford films are, but it
doesn't have the Coen dialogue.
No, well, and it has the, as you talked about, the, you know, John Wayne has to have his happy ending, and that's not what the book had. And I liked that in True Grit, it kept the true ending to the book. So
I quote that movie to this day, the remake.
The remake is fantastic. I'll say I think it's better. And it's amazing that the Coen brothers could take a remake one of the like best Westerns of all time and make it even better and make one of the best Western films of all time on top of it. Yeah. Then if you saw like their Ballad of Buster Scruggs, like it's clear the Coens are really influenced by Westerns, and we could go on and on about, we'll save that for the Western cast. I have pitched in the past to Jay that we should do a Western podcast, but we film every episode around a campfire out in the wild.
Okay, that's amazing. I don't remember that part. Let's do it.
When we get the budget, when we have our Patreon and our Punchies can fund our Montana ranch, then that's when it happens.
All right, that sounds good.
But before then, we're here to talk about Red Sun. So let's talk about Red Sun and talk about why we're covering this on our martial arts podcast. So yeah, let's jump into the movie. And the movie starts with, just like Jay said, the really kind of iconic type of shot that you get from so many of these, the spaghetti westerns, is this rolling landscape, you know, zoom in on a rider moving across the landscape, who comes to railroad stop, who I think like the railroad stop, and especially the spaghetti western, is the spaghetti western version of like a D&D adventure start in a tavern. It's like they almost always start in a railroad stop, and that's where we start. And we're introduced to the train arrives. We see the army is there. There's passengers, a sheriff. We find out the Japanese ambassador is on the train. And most importantly, we're introduced to two shady-looking characters who are also icons, and that is Link, played by the great Charles Bronson. Oh, and by the way, Charles Bronson was also in The Magnificent Seven. Forgot to mention that.
Yes, sir.
And gauche is how they pronounce it, right?
Yeah, it's the French for left. Oh. So droite is right and gauche is left.
Well, we've talked about how I don't know French at all and my pronunciation is awful. So this continues with that trend. Thank you, Dom. And that is portrayed by one of my favorite actors, Alain Delon.
I'm not correcting you. That was fine.
Spot on. The French was perfect.
That pause was awesome.
Yay. So it's interesting, as I mentioned, this came out in 71. Now, Bronson had been big before this. I forget. I think The Magnificent Seven was in like 67. So it was late 60s, right? I mean, he had been in, of course, The Dirty Dozen before. So he'd had a career, obviously a very notable career before this. But I think for people of our generation, and I'm just guessing, you guys can feel free to disagree or not, our image of Bronson comes from his really gritty mid to late 70s movies, The Death Wish, The Mechanic, you know, the Mr. Majestic, and all the also favorite films of my dad. So
yeah, well, Mr. Majestic's amazing, but like I think about it more like, you know, the Death Wish films, where he kind of, not maybe the first one, but kind of like when we were kids, like the 80s films and late 70s, where he's sort of phoning it in.
Oh yeah. By Death Wish 2,
like,
3.
The dude, if you watch this film, you're like, this guy was fucking serious charisma. Like he had things I think he eventually goes away with, like I don't know if there was, but like a comedy about himself, like he didn't take himself too seriously. Like I'm blown away. And again, something right around the same time, once upon a time in, what is it, Mike? I'm blanking.
Once upon a time in the West.
Yes. Thank you, sir. Like same, almost like that was the same character. Was harmonica in that one? So charismatic. I can't even deal with how charismatic he is in this film. Oh, that film versus what we eventually get with like a Death Wish 4, where he just is like barely is. And what you think about when The Simpsons parodies him,
right?
Like, very monosyllabic and stuff like
that. Right.
Yeah. You know, I was thinking that myself. I've only seen Death Wish. Well, let me rephrase that. If you were a child in the 80s and you watched daytime TV, they had like Death Wish 4 on. Yeah. They killed is this. Now they killed this goldfish and he's out for revenge and Death Wish 4 or whatever. Right. And it's like half edited and it's just like stupid. Right. Yeah. And I agree, because like when I watched Death Wish 1 in its entirety, unedited, for the first time, actually, it was in my adulthood. And I'm like, I don't really like this movie. Like, I find him to be really flat. Mm-hmm. Really flat. Like I'm like, this was the most marketable star in the early 70s. This guy, he's kind of a boiled potato. Like, I don't really get it.
Yeah.
Watching this movie jogged my memory of like his older movies, and I'm like, yeah, he's totally got charisma. Actually, it's kind of funny. I always make the joke that my wife tries to watch these movies with me and she can't. She's like, kill me. But this one, she loved it. She absolutely loved it.
Oh, yes.
And I asked her, I'm like, and I asked her point blank, I was like, do you think Charles Bronson is a good actor? And she's like, he's great. And I asked her, I'm like, do you think he's attractive? And she's like, yeah, actually, he's got a lot of charm in this. And
I'm
like,
he's got good taste then.
And I'm like, this is so different than like the Death Wish character.
Yeah, sure, Death Wish like 5, and could be like, who's that? Like, she won't even make.
You know what? I'm on an upward trajectory concerning my marriage. So like, let's just keep it going.
Well, I'm glad Jay mentioned the fantastic Once Upon a Time in the West. That's one to me. I think, in my opinion, that is the best.
I agree.
Western hotel, also movie. Yeah, that is fantastic, and he is so charismatic in that. Right, very reminiscent. This is, I think that's came up, maybe that was 69, out of the, all in, we're in the wheelhouse there.
I just want to make an aside.
Yeah, please.
At one point, Charles Bronson takes his shirt off, and I think I had more like emotional churnings in my straight white man persona than when Ursula Andrews took her shirt off in this film. Like, that dude is like, I can't imagine Charles Bronson was in the gym in the 1950s and 60s. Like, he just is genetically gifted.
Right,
like,
right.
The dude is a fucking brick shit house. I love this man.
Right.
Yeah, that was another reason my wife liked him. She was like, "What?"
That's the big topless scene. Is Charles Bronson in this film?
Yeah. Right.
Not a Bond girl.
Yeah. It's actually kind of funny. So Liz, if you're listening, I'm going to embarrass you. Every time Liz sees someone that she finds attractive, she goes, okay. When Charles Bronson takes off his shirt, she's like, okay. And I'm like, yep, there he is. But he looked great. Like I feel like modern movies, they have like these people that only, you know, like Chris Hemsworth is like, he's only eaten egg whites and drank water for the past 6 months, and then boom, he takes his shirt off and you're like, this is not a human, right? Exactly. I didn't expect it from a early 70s movie, but
right. I didn't know they had six packs back then, but he does. But the other guy that we see is the freaking great French actor Alain Delon, who has, I won't say I have a long history of watching his movies. It really was last year that I dove into Melville's film and discovered Les Samurai, which has become one of my favorites. But then his other great ones like Le Cercle Rouge, and you can.
Okay, now you're crushing the French, Mike. Well done. Oh,
yeah, right.
In a good way.
Yes, but he, in a lot of those great movies. So when Jay told us about this movie, he's like, it's this samurai Western. And I'm like, okay, interesting. And he's like, it's got Toshiro Mifune. So like, okay, well, that makes it legit.
And the first time you're ever hearing him speak English, which I think is kind of cool.
Oh, true. Yeah, so we'll get to him in a moment. But, you know, Bronson, I'm like, okay, well, that's, especially for this era, this is, you know, Western legit. And then I just missed in the entire text, like, wait, Alain Delon is in this too? Like. Yeah. This is, and especially at the time, when you talk about, you know, Bronson and the movies he was in, that Magnificent Seven, Once Upon a Time in the West, The Dirty Dozen, these are all like foundational, inspirational in terms of they inspired future action movies. But then Delon and Melville's films, especially Les Samurai, was a direct influence on so many action films, but especially all the Hong Kong films that we've taught, like all the John Woo films in that. And they're all in this together. So we have this movie has a friggin' stew of all the greatest ingredients of what inspired and created all the movies we love. So Jay,
this is chicken cordon bleu. Like we got chicken, we got ham, we got cheese. Like we're good. We don't need anything
exactly.
else.
So if you're listening and you haven't seen this, know you need to watch it. Know that we are giving you that filet mignon wrapped in bacon with scallops intro into the world of everything that we love.
Oh man, you just outdid me with food. I am humble.
I just used your inspiration and carried it into my own, like these actors in their films did with all the action films we love. So speaking of carrying it out, let's carry into the story. Again, this is like your basic intro, classic intro to a Western. A bunch of shady characters meet up at a train stop. Soon we're on that train, and we get kind of right away, we get to see that Link and Ghosh are connected with each other when they force the sheriff off the train. And then we get a really fun heist scene. So right where they rob the train that is then stopped by shepherds who are soon revealed to be in league with the train robbers as bandits ride up. And we get this really exciting action scene right away with the army that we knew was on the train comes out to move the sheep. And soon they're in the middle of a pitched battle with these banditos. So how'd you guys like their heist? Good heist?
A solid heist.
Yeah.
Because you get to see, you're kind of finally seeing what Link's true colors in that he's a shady fella. And you're seeing Ghosh sort of doing his thing. Again, I guess this is the episode where I come out, but Alain Delon with those blue eyes is just a beautiful man. Yes. And I think he's a solid, if anything, we just don't get enough screen time with him. Like, he just brings so much to the table that I just wanted more with him. But yeah, it's absolutely solid. You know, we're on a train, like you said, Mike, like the train station and then in the train. Like, this is, again, in every conventional Western, there's a train heist, but then you get it through this lens and it's, you know, interesting. And again, what I didn't mention in my spaghetti Western take is a lot of times with your conventional Western, it's, you know, an American dude writing about the West and the American director. This is like, again, I wasn't an Italian director. It was a British or UK director. And I don't know the writers because it went through like a bunch of, I guess it was like rewritten a few times, blah, blah, blah. But it's like through a lens of what they thought the American West was. And it just adds right. that it's like on a tilt. It's almost like a canted angle of what you'd expect from a Western. And it's just so refreshing because it's like, oh, this is what they thought that we were up to. It might have been the truth because we just wanted to sell. So good.
If I can jump in and comment on that, the Western is not real.
Of course not. Yeah, course. It's a sales pitch. It's marketing.
Like it's all fake. I mean, don't get me wrong. There was a gold rush, and there were frontiers, and there were scuffles with Native Americans, and there was crime and lawlessness. But it wasn't that long, you know, and it wasn't that dramatic. And you know, it's mostly fake. Like the Western is mostly fake. I mean,
it's marketing. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it's
mostly fake. Like you could watch a John Wayne movie and it's almost as realistic a Western as The Mandalorian.
Like, right.
Which, by the way, is a Western.
It is. Yes, sir.
Absolutely.
That's what I mean. We're still dealing with the Western, even though we're done with the Western. Western
doesn't take place in the West anymore. Like you got The Mandalorian, you got Logan, you got all these movies.
I was going to say, we might be coming back to the Western in our superhero season.
Talk about Logan.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, so the Western really isn't about the West. It's about a context of morality in a lawless, unexplored environment. That's really what it is.
You got it.
All right. Sorry, I didn't mean the diatribe.
No, that was perfect.
Oh, yeah, exactly. Yeah, you're absolutely right, Dom. And it's just interesting. Jay, I'm glad you reminded us that this director, Terrence Young, directed Bond films, several of the early ones.
I think three of them, at least. Yeah, the iconic stuff, Dr. No from Russia with Love. Like, why is he making this movie?
Right.
It's so weird.
Right. Like, it's just crazy that we got a Bond director.
Yeah.
And we're going to get a Bond girl that we'll talk about in this stew. Again, it's just...
It makes no sense that this movie exists. Like, it's just an anomaly. And I think that's why people don't know about it, because it's just so random. No one knows what to do with it. So they put it in the back of the, like, cinephile cupboard. They're like, it's great. It's everything. I don't know how to tell you about it. So let's talk about a different movie.
Terrence Young, if you look at his rap sheet, it's all over the place.
Yeah.
Like, oh, yeah.
He's got two Bond movies. He's got an Audrey Hepburn movie.
Yeah, Wait Until Dark, which is a classic.
Oh, that's one I got to see.
He's got several of the Charles Bronson. Like he's all over the place.
He is all over the place.
He's all over the place. Dropping dimes is what he's doing. Man. Yeah, so again, just crazy that also there's touches of Bond in this. So we find not only is there gold on this train or money, but there's also, as we'd been told before, the Japanese ambassador was on the train. As the bad guys go investigate the Japanese ambassador's cart, well, I guess we do get to see Toshiro Mifune earlier, briefly in the train stop, but now this is when truly all three of them, Delon, Bronson, and Mifune come face to face in the ambassador's cart, where they discover that the ambassador has this ceremonial sword that he is taking to the president.
I love this cart because it's just it's like they walked into a different movie, but it's in a train cart. Like, it's just so great. Like, everything, even like aesthetically, the art direction is just like, oh, you're in Japan now. And it's inside of, or I guess outside, there's just the American West, which is filmed in Spain. Whatever. It's great.
And I love this scene in particular is one of the centerpiece scenes that really shows off what DeLone does so well. Like, one, he has to be the best, most stylishly dressed cowboy ever. He's just eaten all of that. Mm-hmm. And he just looks right at place in this ornate car and just, quickly absconds with this ceremonial sword.
I'd like to comment on his dress, because that's important, because the spaghetti Western doesn't entirely abandon the tropes. It subverts them. And like in The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly, and in this movie with Ghosh, there is a guy that's just bad to the bone, right? Yeah. The thing is they're not contrasted by a good guy. There's typically a bad, bad, bad guy, and there's like a
less bad guy.
Right.
You know, no one's good. This is like, I made this joke about Game of Thrones. Game of Thrones is Lord of the Rings if everyone was Boromir, and Boromir is the nicest Boromir of all the Boromirs.
Well said. I love that.
So this movie is like, everyone's a crook, but you have these nice crooks, and then you have the bad crook. And Ghosh is the bad crook, and he has the look. He wears a black vest, black hat, black belt, black pants, and he scowls. Oh, yeah. And like, it's like, okay, so this guy is the bad, bad. And it's like, how do you contrast these kind of bad guys against this bad, bad guy?
Those icy blue eyes just make you want to fall into them and love him.
Thank you, Mike.
No, it's even, so Jay had mentioned, might have been you, Dom, and mentioned just one of the traditional tropes in traditional Westerns is good guy white hat, bad guy black hat. That, of course, I think got most iconically used by Lee Van Cleef in like every single movie, especially Good, the Bad, and the Ugly. But in this, like, they're both literally wearing black hats, Bronson and DeLone. And I think it is a visual cue that, like, they're kind of, at least in the beginning, on the same side here, and they're both bandits. It just makes it interesting. There isn't a white hat in this movie, literally or figuratively, which, as Jay explained so well, like, that's part of what makes spaghetti Westerns so interesting.
Arguably, the white hat is the samurai, is Kuroda.
Yeah.
He's the white hat.
Yeah,
he's driven by honor and duty to the point where he's willing to sacrifice himself for it. So in a way... Right.
In 7 days.
Yeah, in a way, it subverts the trope in that the good guy isn't even American. It isn't even like... Oh, he isn't even a Western... And I don't mean from the West. I mean a Westerner as in from the Western Hemisphere. He's... The good guy, if anything, are the Japanese in this, which I think is a wonderful take. And it's very interesting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is. And I mean, that's where we see, right after this, DeLone's true character, Ghosh's true character is revealed by them backstabbing Link, who's played by Bronson. And that's where we discover, as you both said, this is the cost. This is the motivation moving forward is if the Japanese ambassador does not get this sword back, both him and Mifune are going to have to seppuku themselves and commit harikari.
Bronson or Link actually calls it belly sticking.
So many fun terms. And that's really where our adventure begins. Now we know the stakes of what's there, and Link and Mifune from two different worlds are mashed together. Clearly later inspiring Rush Hour.
Stupid. It all leads to Rush Hour. We knew it.
right. So that's really where the story and the journey begins. So I think it's time for us to saddle up our horse and get ready to hit the road. Let's take a break, make sure we've got our stuff packed, and we'll come back and start on the journey to find this stolen sword and that dastardly but beautiful Ghosh. We'll be back.
Welcome to Behind the Studio Door, where we dig into the vibrant creative landscape of Rochester, New York. Hi, I'm Molly Darling, and along with my co-host Christian Rivera and our fabulous producer Chris Lindstrom, it's my pleasure to guide you through the dynamic world of our local creative professionals. Each episode offers a unique glimpse into the studios of those who enrich our Rochester community with their artistic vision. Join us as we explore the diversity and talent in Rochester, revealing the compelling narratives and creative journeys that exist just beyond the studio door.
And we're back to another exciting adventure of Punches and Popcorn and our little side project, Samurai Spring. The movie we are talking about tonight is 1971's Red Sun, that is a combo Western samurai film that we've been gushing all over so far. And the journey continues as our movie really continues with a journey with our rapscallion hero, I guess. Main character, at least, Link.
Anti-hero.
Yeah, well, and spaghetti westerns, they're filled with them, right? As Jay talked about in our great Gospel of the Guillotine. So our anti-hero, Link, is on the road with the samurai, Kuroda, who's played by the great Toshiro Mifune. To me, this is just classic Western. This makes up, I would say conservatively, like 75% of the rest of the movie, journeying on the road across landscapes.
Yeah.
Sweeping vistas.
Yes, sir. I also like it just kind of becomes a buddy movie.
Yeah,
I'm such a sucker for buddy movies. And I just love the middle, the belly of this movie is just two of the most charismatic people ever filmed from different sides of the world, just chilling out. It's just really fun for me.
Yeah, the buddy Western.
Yeah, I love it. I love that. And what I liked about them is it's not only a buddy, it's an odd couple buddy Western. And it's like the coolest pair. So I just love the contrast. One character is a charming, dastardly crook, basically. So he's like, he's almost like that American archetype of the arrogant, unkempt, brash guy who just takes what he wants. And then you have this epitome of honor.
Yes.
Kuroda is the epitome of honor. He's disciplined, and cares about family and history and duty. And he's also kind of a fuddy-duddy. So, like, I love them together. You have this guy who's very charming, yet kind of a jerk. And then you have this guy who is the most honorable person in the world, but he's kind of a fuddy-duddy. And putting them together is really fun. I really enjoyed it.
Absolutely.
Yeah, it's fun because I liken the sequence. While they're traveling, we get these fun moments where Link is trying to escape. Like there's a couple different sequences, but the first one in particular, I think is really notable where he tries to escape by rolling down the hill.
I thought that was odd too.
And he's rolling down the hill, but then Kuroda is like jumping, skipping, running down the hill with him.
Yeah, it's just that perfect show don't tell thing where you're just like, you're not talking about how good he is. He can just casually, you know, maybe haphazardly, but casually jog down a hill while like Link is just rolling like a child down a hill. Like, I thought that was just perfect.
Right. It's just this visually wild sequence to like watch them go down this hill. Like, what the hell is happening? And I just love like the look that Bronson gives when he gets to the bottom and is like, this fucking guy, like he's still here. And then we get that interspersed with, they have kind of their moments of rest, whether it's like, you know, a top of the hill or they have their campfire where they kind of, they take a breather. And that's where we get these moments where we get to know more about Kuroda. And he talks about his perspective on life and, you know, family and all that honor. And, you know, and Link will poke at him a little bit about like, oh, that seems foolish. And
yeah, and we can even talk about like ego, like in terms of the actors themselves. Like, I really think, again, Bronson in the later years would not have allowed this. Like, he lets Kuroda or Mifune like get the best of him, like for most of their time together. Like, he's like, they eventually fight. We're probably jumping ahead here. I'm sorry, but like Kuroda just kicks his ass, like just keeps flipping him over and over. It's so funny, and it's just like, I just think that's so personable that they'd just be like, okay, like the script says, I need to kind of, you know, be the lesser masculine of the two, and I'm gonna allow that. And I think that goes a long way. Like the Bronson we know now, like the iconic thing is is not here. This is like an actor like doing some shit, and it's, I don't know. I'm very charmed by their relationship.
I agree with that. It subverts the American masculine archetype.
Because yes,
when you think about
you.
These traditional Westerns, it's like the white American is the ultimate in one, virtue, two, masculinity, and three, ambition. Like, that's what we see in all these movies. And here,
right,
it's the opposite. Here, the American is, you know, he's kind of a dope. He's charming. Like,
yes,
he can charm people. But like, as far as integrity and honor, he doesn't have any of those things. And you have an Easterner who is the epitome of all of these things. And he kicks so much ass. And I remember watching the movie and I'm like, this actually kind of makes sense. If you have the ambassador to America, mm-hmm. the bodyguards for this guy are going to be top tier warriors. So it makes sense right. that Kuroda comes from a lineage of like mighty samurai warriors. Like, I love the part where they fight. He's like, you think you could do that again? And he's like, oh, most certainly.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, that's right. We get like the funny sequence, which I wonder, I guess maybe he never saw a sword before, but he's like, so Bronson attacks him after this is like the second time, you know, they have their night where they rest. And then he later again goes with his move is push this guy down a hill. So he pushes Kuroda down the hill, then is surprised when he's like right back up and he attacks him with a stick. And he's like shocked when he cuts the stick to pieces. I'm like, does he not know what a sword is?
It could be. This is like 1800, like set in 1860s, I think it said. So maybe they haven't seen swords yet.
Right. And I don't know. But he finds that, you know, and he kind of challenges him, like gives him basically the like, oh, you wouldn't be so tough without that sword. And I love that Kuroda's like, okay, and puts the sword away and is like, yep, let's do this. And then we get this great fight. It's great that it shows like Bronson, like, okay, now I'm on my ground and nope, you're still outmatched here.
And as someone who does grappling martial arts, particularly judo, and he's like, make a fist. He's like, I don't need to make a fist. And I'm like, yeah. Grappling trumps striking. I don't really believe that, but it was just great to see. He, by the way, he did like textbook judo there. Like,
I assumed it was judo.
He does a Tominagi, he does a Sotogari, and he does like three drop Sayanagis in a row. That's one of the things I actually like about judo. I say that judo is like, I think judo is the ultimate bar fight martial art. And here's my logic. Because if a drunk guy comes at you swinging his fist, or a thug is trying to like posture swinging his fist, and you put him on the ground, he's going to be like, like it's that kind of immediacy of dropping someone. Without hitting them, that like really humbles someone. And I think this movie's a perfect example. He's like, I'm just going to keep putting you down on the ground until you decide not to get up. And that's exactly what happens in this movie. I love that
scene. Right.
And another thing to think about is it's not only that he's a superior warrior. It's not only that he's honorable, but they also don't diss his culture too.
Right.
Like when they're eating and, you know, he's like, what is that? Oh, and he eats it. He's like,
yeah, the smell.
That's delicious. He's like, that's really
good. That's tasty.
I was sitting there and I'm like, and I'm Italian and I'm saying this. The Japanese know their food. Japanese food is tops. And so I like how they acknowledge this. Like, this is a fleshed out, advanced, sophisticated society. It's not just like the lesser of the West. Like, and I think it's really progressive in that.
Yeah, just as an aside, I wanted to comment that this is kind of against character for Mifune, too. I mean, he played samurai a million times. He's, I think for most of us Westerners, like, he's the image of the samurai. And
yeah, the default samurai, yeah.
Especially the, like, black and white Kurosawa films. But in a lot of his most memorable roles, like in Seven Samurai, in Rashomon, in Yojimbo, he kind of plays more of a, kind of like Bronson, he plays more of a rascally, kind of wild character. You know, especially in Seven Samurai, his character is way more in common with movie than Kuroda. So it's interesting that, again, he has played like this kind of almost cliched, just because we've seen it so much, but the stoic samurai. But it really is like greatest, most notable roles. He's kind of the like loudmouthed asshole kind of. So it's interesting, right? He kind of plays a little bit differently as well, but as we said, like, we get to see him, like, nope, he's still a badass in a very different way than Bronson is. And we get to see them soon after this team up when they come upon a homestead and find Gosh's men robbing and killing some farmers, homesteaders. That was really fun.
An interesting contrast that they have there is that it's a farm, really. It's got a mom and a dad and daughters. And the father is like, they're like, where are your daughters? And he's like, and he calls him a bendejo.
Right.
Which is, by the way, exactly what any of us, I hope, would do if someone's like, where's your daughter? It's like, no,
right.
Do your worst, you know?
Right.
And it's funny, the contrast of their responses to the unfortunate death of this man, where Kuroda is like, he's a brave man because he's willing to sacrifice himself for his family. Mm-hmm. And then you have Link, who's like, stupid.
Right, right.
The like independent, isolated, everything's out for yourself kind of crook versus this honor, duty, family kind of perspective.
Yeah.
Right. And it builds on this whole, it's this continuous narrative through the movie about these guys and, you know, who see each other as very different and see the world very differently. But it's just as, again, like, that even in this action, we're coming back to that conversation as they're slowly kind of getting to know each other beyond assumptions, but starting to also understand this is your perspective, this is where it comes from, which I think really makes this interesting, especially because it's such a mashup of cultures in how the movie was made. And it's funny too, because they didn't like go there to go save people. They went there to go steal horses and then came upon the bad guys there.
Right.
So it's even in that, like, they aren't like the, again, the quote unquote, the white hats riding in to save people. They're, we were going to go steal horses and then we found these guys we hate and they're doing bad stuff. And I guess we probably should get in the middle of this.
Have we talked about the ticking clock that maybe they got to steal because, like, this 7 days until this man, you know, belly sticks himself. Like, we maybe have to do some stealing.
Right, right. Well, and I like they give us that kind of the visual representation of the belt with the knots that Kuroda's wearing that has the seven knots on it. So as they journey and things, we'll see, like, they'll specifically show him untying one of the knots and then kind of sighing. And it's just a nice, fun, like, easy visual way to see, yep, time is going by. And then just the, like, really quick reaction we'll get from Kuroda, like, gives us just a really quick moment, which, again, this is just speaks to the breadth of talent that Toshiro Mifune has, and that he can just in a quick reaction let us understand that, yep, he feels this weight and he feels this clock too. And it's just a nice way to move through that without really slowing down the narrative.
Right.
Yeah, really interesting. All right, so they go and they stop the bad guys, right? And they...
Okay, let's talk. We're a martial arts podcast. Let's talk about the violence here, because it was great.
Please do.
I mean, it's a very sad setup. This guy gets executed in front of his presumably wife. But man, like, and it's also a plot device. Like, if you killed these guys before that, you might be like, did they deserve it? Now you're like, fuck those guys.
Right. Right.
And it's great to see. I mean, the Kendo's a martial art, so it counts for our podcast.
Yeah.
Because Kuroda goes ham on these guys, stabs one of them, turns over the sheet, blah, and stabs him. Cuts the other guy's face in half. If this movie was made more recently, that would have looked way more Mortal Kombat-y. They did the best they could. It's like, you know that they were like, you get the point. He cut his head in half. And I was like, throwing darts and shit. I was like,
oh, yeah.
And of course, you got Bronson gunslinging, which does, you know, he's great. That scene is sick. Oh, it's so good.
Oh, yeah. But they get the horse. Then we get kind of, again, just another, like, showing their the differences in their culture and background and some of the mistaken assumptions. You know, Link gives Kuroda a horse. And the assumption there is that, like, this guy doesn't know how to ride it. He's probably going to get thrown. And I'm going to get away because he's still, no matter what, he's trying to get out of there. But even though Kuroda recognizes that he was given a shitty horse, he's still able to, after a little bit of trouble, able to wrangle it. And nope, you're not getting away that easy. And Link kind of gives us a little more about his motivation here. He tries to make this deal with Kuroda, like, hey, okay, when we find this guy, Ghosh, I don't want you to kill him because he's after his money. He wants his money. He wants to know where Ghosh hid it because, of course, this is the West. You're not going to ride around with bags full of money on you. So he asks him to spare him, which at this point, Kuroda is not willing to. He's
spare him for a day.
Yeah, 24 hours.
He's like, I'm just asking for you to put a pin in this so I can get my money, which honestly is not the most unreasonable thing in the world.
I thought it was reasonable, yeah.
Yeah, which shows you Kuroda's rigidity. He's very rigid, almost to a fault.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Because a lot of the annoyance, we'll call it, could have been avoided if he was just like, yeah, sure, whatever. Let's get through it. But no, he's like, no.
Nope. But Kuroda soon is able to kind of let his guard down a little as our heroes soon find themselves journeying to another staple of the Western, especially the spaghetti Western, is the Western whorehouse, the brothel.
Yeah, gotta get there.
And this is where we meet our Bond girl, Ursula Andress, because again, a Bond director. There's Charles Bronson. There's Toshiro Mifune. There's Alan Delon. Oh, there's one of like the most iconic Bond actresses of all time. Ursula Andress is in this also playing a hooker.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and they managed to get a time machine back a hairdryer because her hair is blown out way. She did not look like she came from the like everyone else kind of looks dirty and musky and kind of. And I'm like, you look like you have a shower. You look like you have a makeup staff. You look like you have a hairdryer. She kind of looked out of place. I'm sorry. Like her clothes looked out of place.
She was radiating for sure. And you wonder, madam in a brothel in the 1800s out in the frontier, maybe not as glamorous, but you just can't keep the glow away from Ursula because she's incredible. But basically what we find out is that Christina, the character she plays, is the girlfriend of Ghosh, and they expect he's going to come and visit her, so we're going to use her as bait. And to use her as bait, they literally, like, not just lock her into the room, but, like, hammer and board her into that room.
Yeah, ladies, another spaghetti Western thing, they don't get a lot of, like, great, you know, they're not treated super well. Like, it's always going to be a whorehouse and you're a prostitute and like that. A lot of times there won't even be women in these films. So when there are, it's a bummer because they're treated so poorly, like narratively wise. So that is an unfortunate spaghetti Western trope too, that there isn't a lot of great representation there.
Yeah. This representation, something I'm sure we'll talk about a little bit later in the movie too. In most spaghetti Westerns, if you have a woman, she's probably a whore.
And Westerns.
Yeah, honestly, right.
Yeah.
Right.
A whore, a nun. Uh-huh. Sometimes there's like religious women or a farmer's wife or daughter.
Yeah, it's the damsel, right?
They're always damsels. Yeah.
She's an object.
The heart of gold, though. That's
right. Right. But we find, some of the other women in that brothel have hearts of gold, or at least hearts for gold, as the movie would probably portray it. And our two heroes get a little bit of rest and spend the night with some women. So I was surprised by this. I thought maybe they're going to show. I thought maybe they're going to show like, oh, the samurai here, I have honor, I don't. Which would be
not here,
because like if you know the history, like there's a long history of prostitution in Japan at this time, and that in these feudal kingdoms, so this wouldn't be anything unusual to a samurai of the Tokugawa shogunate, and he doesn't seem uncomfortable at all. And
absolutely not. Honor's out the window, Mike. There's a naked lady, and he's going to indulge.
Yeah, and we get boobs. Like, I feel like you don't get boobs a lot in these movies, but we do. So
we do. B-E-W-B, boobs.
Yeah. This is our legacy, guys.
anything goes in Samurai Spring. So again, our heroes get a nice relaxing night, get to let their hair down a little bit. And the next morning, some of those gauche banditos show up and confrontation. So a bunch of these banditos show up and our heroes got to fight them off. And they end up taking out all of them except for one left alive. And then it's time to get back on the road with that bandito and Christina. The road journey continues. Step two of their plan to get the sword. This is a Tachi. Is that right, Dom? Am I pronouncing that right?
Yeah, it's a golden Tachi. So that's, to be fair, I thought it might have been. I don't really know the difference between the swords as far as what all the sources have said about this. It's like the proper term is a Tachi.
Okay.
It's not a katana, but whatever. I mean, it's ceremonial. And, right. And it's a symbol of it's a gift, really. So it's a, but also like this is a big part of diplomacy. Like we haven't stepped back and talked about Japan at this time. Whereas sure. Japan used to be a very much isolationist, is now like, you know what, we're falling behind. The world's a big place. Let's get in on the ground floor of this, you know. And this kind of diplomacy that they're depicting, even fictionally, in this movie. Really is what led to Japan's dominance in the 20th century, right? Because it became like a superpower.
Right.
Because it was willing to work with the big dogs. It was willing to work with the big dogs in the West.
Right. And I like that we get the moment where Kuroda talks a little bit about these changes happening in Japan and how it affects people like him and his class and that. So we get some context there that I think is really, it's helpful to understand, you know, fully this guy, who he is, where he comes from, what his life is like. I just like that he's a fully fleshed out character in a way that maybe in other movies like wouldn't be at the time, which again, there's not every different type of person in this movie, as we'll get to, is necessarily greatly fleshed out, but I like that at least between Link and Kuroda, between the, you know, the outlaw and the samurai, we really get time for them to kind of understand each other and, you know, recognize where they come from. So they come up with this plan, their own act of diplomacy, where they send the bandit that they had taken from the attack on the brothel, send him to Gosh and say, okay, you bring us the sword, we'll give you Christina, which she's super thrilled about. I like that, to her credit, like, she never stops being pissed at those guys.
Even when she pretends she's not pissed, she's yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Right. She's ride or die for her Alain Delon, which
she is.
As we have revealed through this podcast, at least Jay and I are both very much the same for
LA. We get it.
We get it. We get it, Ursula. It makes sense. And this time, when they make this deal, Link finally gets Kuroda to agree, okay, don't kill this guy right away. I need to find out where the gold is. So they're kind of seeing eye to eye by now. They're kind of liking each other a little bit.
Well, I mean, he does steal his clothes while he's naked in the store.
Yeah.
Right. That's some hard negotiation tactic. He wasn't like, he didn't appeal to his better angels. He's like, you can do what I want.
Right. So, you know, either way, they seem like they have come to an agreement just in time for Christina to fly the coop and escape. And what really stops this is the introduction of probably the most unfortunate characters in this movie, the Comanche.
All right. Those are the most Italian-looking Native Americans I've
met. Yeah.
Yeah. It's so obviously one of the tropes of Western movies is Native American bad guys.
Of course.
That are pretty faceless and have no existence in the film other than to be the bad guys.
The cannon fodder.
Right. And
all that like ambiguity and nuance goes right out the window. Yeah, it's just like even spaghetti westerns are doing the same thing, unfortunately.
If I remember right, they're never mentioned. Maybe they're hinted at in other parts of the movie, but they basically come out of nowhere and
They're hinted at a couple of times. So very subtly, they said, oh, you got to watch out for the Comanches at one point. And then there's another part where they get to the rendezvous point and it's just like, it's dead. It's basically a ghost town. And they're like, oh, the Comanches were here. And so there's some foreshadowing that doesn't forgive the clear racism, but
nope.
Right, right. It, there's part of me that, and I know this is giving probably undeserved credit, but there's part of me that's like, well, you know, they're Europeans. They don't really understand America and the West. They're just mimicking what they saw in the movies there. But that would also be denying the, like, it's not like Europeans don't understand what colonialism is and mm-hmm. what that does to the people who are in those places. So probably can't really let them off the hook.
I don't know. I'm going to totally give a diatribe. I just watched that show Dark Winds. Have you seen that?
Oh, I got to watch that.
Oh, I want to watch that.
It's amazing. And I'm going to say this. Even in the 70s, we treated Native Americans like fucking garbage.
Oh, yeah.
I think we treated them like garbage.
Currently, even.
So yes. I don't buy it.
I agree.
I think that white people saw Native Americans as lessers at the time and had no problem using them as the nameless, faceless bad guys.
Yeah.
I'm not letting anyone off the hook here. I'm
yeah,
saying,
yeah, good.
Really bad.
Right. Yeah, you're right. Yeah, and again, they really only show up here to stop Christina from getting away and give them the opportunity, our heroes, the opportunity to rescue her and go back to the rendezvous where they surprise. Now we're into the end game here, where Ghosh and his gang have been waiting for them. So the showdown here seems like our heroes have been surprised. This may not go the way they expect. Our heroes could be in trouble. Except here come the Comanches again! Like, it's just a 1-2 punch. And now these evil Indians are what will get us all to be buddies again. So I'll get to their showdown at the end. It's very cringe, right? That the catalyst for all the action at the end comes with faceless Indians coming to attack them for really no reason that we can tell. We've right. never seen any confrontation with them before to know, like, oh, they're also after these guys. All the conflict we've been shown is Gaush and his gang and these two trying to get their money and the sword back. Now we're introduced to, oh, these Indians are here because I guess they just like killing us.
Yeah, I feel like this is a I hate saying this, but I'm going to say it. This is a pre-woke trope.
Oh, very.
Like, think about it. In the Western, you have either banditos or Native Americans that yep. just facilitate action and are used as cannon.
Yeah.
You have, like, movies like Indiana Jones, even. You have, like, the natives that are just throwing spears at you for no reason, you know. And I'm sure there's plenty of other movies like that. I just thought of, you know, yeah. The Lost Ark. There's always this, like, hunter-gatherer native group that will just try to kill you because you're physically there. And that trope, it's in King Kong. It's in, like, all of these movies. Basically, you need brown people to want to kill you for no other reason than the fact that you're there.
Yeah, it is. It definitely sours a little bit at the end of the movie. I will say the one thing I like, you know, they're all on the same side fighting the Comanche now. And I do really enjoy visually the scene they get where they're kind of trapped in the high grass. And we get just some really interesting visuals with it. We get drama added to it when the Comanche set the grass on fire. So not only are they being attacked, but they're being smoked out. The action and intensity there during the showdown is shot really well. It's just unfortunate that the people doing it isn't any of the bad guys that we've built tension on through the whole movie. It's here's the Indians.
Mm-hmm.
And another thing that's interesting is during this firefight, he's like, give me back the sword. And Ghosh is like, who fucking cares? Give him back the sword. Like,
right. Yeah, that is interesting.
It was almost a trifle. In this whole thing, took it. This whole thing is because Ghosh got greedy and they're like, please don't take this, just take the money and go. And he's like, no, I'm just gonna be a dick and take the sword. And this whole thing could have been avoided if this thing that he really was just a trifle, he just left.
Right.
Yeah, it was just a side effect a side thing that he's like, basically, I see a big shiny, I want the big shiny. I'm going to take this. Like, yes, we've got all the gold. Yes, we've got all this. But there's just this one thing, and I want to take it.
It's almost Greek in a way.
Yeah.
Yeah, you're a career crook. I get it. But your hubris is what led to your death here. Your hubris is what led to the end.
Right. And that's where, in the end, we find, you know, as these three, Kuroda, Link, and Ghosh, kind of show down, Ghosh shoots Kuroda, and Link now stands up for and comes to the aid of Kuroda and kills Ghosh.
Yeah, and like, it's funny how Kuroda's response seems almost like Link's response would be in that situation. He's like, why did you do that? You won't get your money. He's like,
right.
Like, why did you do that? And Link basically says, he's like, because you're my friend in a way. Like,
yeah.
Right, right. Like, they've come that far that they understand each other. And you're right, that they kind of, through that conversation at the end, as our hero Kuroda is dying, we see that, no, now Link understands and cares about this guy. But then that also Kuroda understands, like, hey, I know you were going after this money. I'm surprised that you would make this sacrifice, basically. You know, so they've got, they're fully buddies now.
Yeah,
time to see one of them die.
And I really like when Ghosh is about to kill Link and Kuroda's behind him, and Link's like, kill him. Like, it's fine. Like, he's abandoned all his, like, I don't need the gold. Just kill this fucker.
Yeah,
and right. Of course, unfortunately, Ghosh turns around and gets Kuroda. But I was just like, at that point, like, Link is fully on board with Kuroda's like deal. Like, he's just like, I just really like this guy. I don't need the money. It's really moving.
Yeah, it's respect. They respect for each other. I mean, I can't see how you don't respect Kuroda.
I know you can't.
Kind of a fuddy-duddy, right. But like, I mean, he's willing to die for his mission. Like, it's pretty impressive,
right? And in wrapping this up, you know, Link, who really has no reason to, other than now he's truly a friend. He sees Kuroda as a friend. Agrees that, yep, I'm going to take this sword back to the ambassador, and you know, I'll make sure that your mission is accomplished. Even though you aren't around, I'm not just going to ride off into the sunset. And correct me if I'm wrong, but I mean, Kuroda even kind of tells him, like, well, you could get caught. You could get in trouble. Like, you could go to jail.
Yeah.
You know, basically telling him, like, you don't have to do this. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm dying, but that Link is willing to.
Yeah, it's pretty moving.
It is. It is. But I like that we get kind of our final moment here in the movie. Is we see that train coming back to the train stop again, full circle back to the train stop where we all started. And yep, Link is there, but he isn't just standing there waiting to get arrested with the sword. Nope, he's got that hanging off and he's riding off into the distance. So we get that the classic Western ending where our hero, anti-hero, rides off into the sunset.
One thing I'd like to mention is it's interesting that Christina's arc is not an arc. She is, from start to finish, with Ghosh. Like, it's amazing. Like, when Link kills Ghosh, she's like, yeah, she gets so mad. And then she's like, oh, well, he's dead now, so I'm going to try to fool this guy and try to get the money. And he's like, no, I'm not putting up with you. It's enough.
Right.
Her character is refreshingly consistent.
Yes.
Yes. Yeah, agreed.
The prostitutes in this movie, some of them are very nice. But, you know, one of the women's like, oh, my dad sold me to this brothel. I was like, oh, you poor, poor thing. And then you have Christina, though. Christina's hard. Like, she's like, I'm with Ghosh. I want the money. I'm with my man.
Yeah, agreed. And that is Red Sun. Again, Jade, awesome movie. All right. I am very excited to see where our doctor brings in science to this movie. So, Dr. Dom, are you ready?
With science! Yes, science! Science! It's not rocket science! Just say yes and we'll move on!
Science! I don't think science knows, actually.
Fly with me! With science!
Actually, before I dig in, I just realized something. In that little intro, you have Will Ferrell playing Harry Carey, right? The announcer, I believe he's a sports announcer, right?
Yeah.
And Harry Carey sounds very similar to Harakari, which is the ceremonial suicidal disemboweling. So
I never put that together.
Yeah. So there's a random homonym connection there.
Yeah.
All right, anyway, it's a science segment. So if you recall, when the Comanche, you know, who clearly have no personalities. They, for some reason, start harassing Christina, right? They rip her off her horse. She defends herself by stabbing one of them. And they're like, boo, how could you do that? They don't say that, of course. so they try to kill her by tying her up, taking a piece of rawhide, wetting it, wrapping it around her neck, and then leaving her out in the sun. And the idea is that the rawhide will dry and constrict and choke her and asphyxiate her and kill her, right? That's the idea. So let's talk about that. And I got to admit, this wasn't my idea. This was your guy's idea. So let's talk about it. So rawhide. Whoopsh. All right. So rawhide is animal skin, really. But it's not leather. So rawhide is animal skin that's not tanned. And leather is animal skin that's tanned. Rawhide can come from the skin of pretty much most animals. But typically, it comes from big game or livestock. And what happens is you take the animal, you skin the animal, right? And you strip the skin of the hair on the outside, so the hair and typically the epidermis. And then on the underside, fat and fascia and muscle and anything under there. So pretty much all you're left behind with is the dermis, right? Now, the dermis of most animals is made up of two types of connective tissue, areolar connective tissue and dense connective tissue. Right. And dense connective tissue has lots of collagen and elastin fibers. And it's those large amount of protein fibers that gives leather and rawhide its strength. Now, with rawhide, what happens is you just stretch that dermis out and you shrinks and it hardens. Right. And it gets pretty hard. Right. But when you wet it, it becomes soft again and you can reshape it. But after a while, if you keep it wet, it'll rot. Right. Now, most of you have actually encountered rawhide if you have a dog. If you've ever bought one of those dog chew toys that like feels really hard and white and is typically tied up to kind of look like a bone, that's rawhide. So when they chew on it, it softens it. But when it's dry, it's rock hard. And that's what rawhide is. So it actually could happen. Rawhide shrinks, it expands when you wet it, and it shrinks when you dry it. So by taking rawhide, wetting it, wrapping it around an object, and leaving it out to dry, it will shrink, and it could potentially be used as a weapon in this way. And it has been. I looked around, and there was some talk that Comanches were doing this, but no official sources, just people talking, so it might be a myth. But
people who watch this movie.
Well, like, which shouldn't surprise anyone. Europeans actually used it as a torture device. And we used it as a torture device.
We are so good at torturing people.
Yeah, we're so good at torturing people. As something called the buskin or the boot, which is where you take wet rawhide, you make a shoe out of it, you put someone's foot in it, and then you put it their foot over a gentle flame to heat it up. That causes the rawhide to constrict and dislocate the bones in your foot, which is used as a torture device. Yes.
Ah, so lesson here is if a German says Das Boot to you, you know you're in for a good time. But if a Scot says Das Boot to you, get the fuck out of there.
Yeah, so a wet rawhide boot was put on your foot. And yeah. And by the way, there's all kinds of foot tortures I found out about that I don't want to talk about. So yeah, so the idea that you use shrinking rawhide as a torture or murder device makes a lot of sense and has been done throughout history. So there's actually some accuracy to this, which is crazy.
Amazing.
Now, since we're talking about rawhide torture, I stumbled upon something that you wouldn't believe. We have to talk about arguably one of the, if not the most famous Western television shows, Rawhide. It has that very famous song, Rollin', Rollin', Rollin',
Rollin'. Rawhide.
Whoosh. Yeah, everyone knows that, right? So here's the thing. When the torture methods of the CIA became declassified, one of the ways that they would torture people is they would play certain songs at extremely high volumes in the dark for prisoners 24/7 to drive them nuts. Like, you think that they could pick any song. If you play it at high volumes for over 24 hours in the dark, it's going to drive you nuts. So they picked several songs. One of those songs is none other than the Blues Brothers version of the song Rawhide.
Really?
So Rawhide Torture is, in modern context, not the actual material, but the song Rawhide. You can't make this shit up. Rolling, rolling, here you go.
Fabulous. Oh, fantastic, Dom. I always learn something and learned a lot here. So thank you. And I totally forgot about that moment. That was, I've never seen something like that in a film before. So that was very odd. Just one of the many gifts that this crazy film has. So, Jay, thank you for bringing this into our lives. And if you're listening and you haven't seen it, please go out and check this out. Jay, is there like a boutique Blu-ray, some sort of physical media for this that we can seek out with even more gifts on it?
Yeah, so basically there's nothing stateside currently, but there's a Studio Canal. They're a UK company. They put out a Blu-ray of this, and I think it's 4K as well. So it comes with a 4K disc and a Blu-ray disc of the film. I don't know why it's literally... just until recently, thanks to Tubi, I guess. And I actually saw it on Criterion Channel a few years ago. But it's kind of really hard to see stateside until recently. I'm not exactly sure why. But long story short, the only disc you can get now is what I mentioned. It's a UK disc from Studio Canal. It's picture's great. It doesn't have a lot of special features. There's a quick interview with like Japanese scholars, like 20 minutes about... Mifune, but it's more about like his career overall and not anything like specific to the film. I'd love more. I want to know more about the film itself.
Right.
So not a lot of great supplements, but a great presentation. It is region locked because it's Blu-ray. So you need like a region B player. So currently nothing stateside. Hopefully soon.
Yeah. You would think this movie that's a combination of all these great talents, both acting and directing, that this would be more known and that there's got to be more story there. So I had a very interesting. All right. Well, guys, this is a blast. This is a great one to start Samurai Spring with, even though very non-traditional, but I love that it gave us the opportunity to talk about multiple genres and how they really all come together, which I think is really important. So great stuff. Jay, I can't wait to figure out what we're going to do next. So again, thank you for listening, friends. If you don't follow us on social media, we are on Instagram, Blue Sky, at Punches and Popcorn. You can find us there. If you have your own thoughts that you want to share, samurai movies you want to do, you can email us at punchesandpopcorn@gmail.com. And of course, don't forget to listen to our buddies, our fellow shows on our Lunchador podcast network. Some of the great ones you can check out that I highly recommend. There is Dialed In, a coffee podcast that talks about the coffee scene here in Rochester. Really great insight there. And I personally just can't get enough coffee. Of course, our great friend and multiple time guest on our show, Jackie McGriff, has her Our Voices Project, a Representation in Cinema podcast. Check that out. Also, Behind the Studio Door, looking into the Rochester art scene. Nights and Weekends is one of our newest ones, but really gets into the Rochester and surrounding areas music scene. A lot of really good insider stuff there. And then, of course, we can't leave out Anomaly Presents, the podcast that really kind of birthed us from our friends at the Anomaly Film Festival, celebrating just a wide range of awesome genre films. So check them out, give them a listen. And if you like what you hear on whatever podcast app you're on, give us a review. Thank you. Good night. And Rawhide!
This has been a presentation of the Lunchador Podcast Network.
The Level Up Coffee Podcast is now dialed in. We love coffee and stay connected to every development in the industry, both here in Rochester and worldwide, to bring you our unique perspective on the ever-changing world of coffee.
We're doing regular tastings, reporting on our travels, and trying to hold back tirades about the forces that make the coffee supply chain a neo-colonial mess. Join us on the Lunchador Podcast Network and wherever you get your podcasts, and stay
dialed in.